Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of March 8th, 2024. This is Charles Hay, and I'm here with Jason Hellerman.
Good morning.
And Gigi Hawkins.
Good morning.
And today we are talking about managing your career and how to take a general meeting. But before that, we have an update on current projects. Gigi.
Yes, update from the trenches in real time of making my first feature, a micro-budget indie. Charles and Jason, you've been with me on the journey at many stages, helping me navigate things. And it's always just good to give updates in real time for these little micro moments that you don't really think about. And so the thing that's happening today on March 4th, 2024, is that I am showing a cut of the movie to two of the actors, which is kind of weird and something that I never would have thought about otherwise. And I'd love to hear, like, if you guys have, at what stage have you shared with talent? And I'll give you my sort of reason for why I'm sharing with talent at this stage. And it's just one of those little, like, parts of the journey.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, that is way earlier than I ever share anything with talent. So congratulations. That's amazing. I usually wait. So there is a thing that I realized really early in my career where, like, people will say things like, oh, I'm capable of watching a rough cut, or I can watch it without color, or I can watch it without sound mix or whatever. And in my experience, I learned really early that that was never true.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, no matter how hard, like, no matter how experienced someone was, the sound mix and the color and the score and everything was so vital that, like, I basically show it to no one until it is all done, except for, like, very specific test screenings with very experienced filmmakers. And honestly, even then with filmmakers, I find that, like, it's hard for them to see through a bad sound mix. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, like, it's just a hard thing to do if you don't know and love the project. So I always wait to show to talent until, like, it is done.
Also,
I mean, I love actors. The actors are wonderful. Actors do a very special and magical thing. But I also feel like actors, like, feedback on a rough cut is very, it is often hard for an actor to see beyond their performance to the overall good of the whole project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, even when, like, the project is done, I still feel like a good actor has invested so much in the reality of their character that they are only going to view the film through that perspective.
Yeah.
And won't always be able to see, like, they're going to be able to be like, oh, but I, you know, there's this backstory thing that you cut out. And it's like, well, yeah, but I cut it out because it's not actually relevant and it informed your performance, but the audience doesn't need to know it. And, like, so I always wait. I don't know the last time I showed performers in mid, like, before we were completely polished and finished. On the flip side, if your performers are advocates for you and really excited about the project and they feel like they did good work, it can be a tremendously, like, rewarding thing when you mm-hmm. have that thing where you share the thing with the performer and you're like, ah, they loved it.
Look what you did.
Yeah.
In the best way. Look what you've done, like a look what you did celebration. Yeah,
I also feel like it's really odd. I mean, this is not, like, relevant advice. This is just anecdotal. But, like, the weirdest thing about post is you feel like you are spending time with these people.
I know.
I remember going to a screening once. No, it wasn't a screening. I was out to dinner once and I'd been color grading this project and it'd been edited at my post house. So I'd seen, like, a dozen rough cuts and I knew the director. And then I had been color grading this project for, like, 2 weeks. So, like, I was hanging out with these people. And then I went to dinner and, like, two tables over was one of the actors. And I was like, I feel like I've just spent the last 3 months with you and you have never met me.
Yeah.
I do not know if I should say hi or not. I did say
you?
Hi. Oh,
you did.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a chatty dude. So I went up and I said hi. And I was like, oh, we've been editing this project at my post house. And then we're in the color grade now. So I feel like I'm hanging out with you all the time. And you've never met me. And he's like, yeah, I've never met you, but nice to meet you. And he was very nice. We had a nice little chat. But like, it was the strangest, very Los Angeles moment.
I love it.
Because you're
that.
Like, I feel like I know you.
You're like, I know you. I know your little micro habits. I've seen
yeah,
you
your
in
mannerisms.
Take. Exactly. And it's also so intimate to be editing someone and like watching, like slowing down and watching how they blink their eyes and watching them. Like, it's very intimate.
Also, he was like shirtless in most of the movie and had like a sex scene. So I was like, I feel like I've spent an inordinately large amount of time with you.
Yeah.
And I know exactly like what your back hair looks like. And yeah. And here we are at a nice fancy restaurant on Sunset Boulevard.
It reminds me of, we had John Philpott, the editor of Theater Camp on from Sundance two years ago. It's a great DP roundtable, or it's a great editor post roundtable. We have some folks from sound. We have editors talking about that post-production process. And on his way to Sundance, John came out of the bathroom at the airport and there was one of the Theater Camp kids standing there. And he was like, hey, Derek. And the kid was like, you're not my dad. Like, had that stranger danger look in his eyes. And then, of course, John explained to the parent, like, I edited the movie. I spent a lot of time with the kid, but it was their first time meeting. It was also the first time that John met the DP of the film, Nate Hertzellers, in passing at the No Film School House. So it was one of those like things where you, like, the person who is holding the camera, connecting with the person who is seeing the footage of the camera, like all these sort of strange moments. What I think is, what I'm excited about with showing to these two actors are, we kind of have the spectrum of talent and experience. So I've already shown a cut to the lead, Madison Lanacy, who wrote and starred in a short that I did last year. And what's interesting about working with her and why I feel like I can show her things at these earlier stages is once she sees it and sort of like gets over, she has to do like a watch or two where she's like seeing her performance. Then she starts referring to the character as the character. Including when we were doing this short, Yes, Daddy, she would refer to the character who is also, she named Madison. She wrote it. She named Madison. But she would say, oh, she's doing this. She's doing that. Oh, this is her thing. And so she was able to like separate it. And then with the two characters who, or the two actors who are seeing this cut, one of them, it was their first time on set. They're a model, Arta G. And they have an incredible fight reel on their Instagram, worth checking out. But they, I was trying to explain sort of a choice that we made over this title that we're going with. And I was like, you kind of have to see the film to get it. And then the other person that we're showing it to is the second lead, Travis Quinton Young, who has been, who has done a ton of movies his whole life. He's been on camera his whole life. So it'll be like somebody who's used to seeing themselves on screen in this way and somebody who is not used to seeing themselves on screen this way. So what I'm going to do is ask Travis, like, how do you have perspective? So Arta can then be prepared to see themselves. And actually, I think I'm going to show them the movie twice so they can like get through the first like initial processing of it and then go back and watch it again, which is actually how I watched the first cut of the movie. Like, I watched it and then I immediately watched it again. So I'll report back on how that goes. It's just one of those like weird things you don't really think about. And I know Jason mentioned this last week on the podcast, but we're collecting information for some videos that we can make about how we made the movie. So if you go to ggehawkins.com/survey, you can fill that out. And so we can like conduct, make these videos that are answering your questions. And it's been really helpful to get that feedback already. So yeah, updates from the trenches of the movie.
Woo!
That is amazing. That is great. And, you know, everybody has different processes. Like, there are people who are showing, you know, like, some people love to, like, make a cut while they're shooting and then show something at the wrap party. And, like, you know. Like,
were you telling me that about Kevin Smith? Were we talking about that on the podcast?
We definitely
did. That wasn't
did.
Me. Someone else
it was me telling you that. Yeah. The other one here. Yeah.
It's incredible. Like, what a different experience to be able to wrap at the wrap party, scream a cut of the film. I mean, that feels like it would just be like all good vibes and people really proud of what they're doing. And it also goes to show that there is no one right way. Cause like, I definitely know my partner and his writing directing partner, they do not show the actors until the premiere. It's like done. And it's just like, well, here it is, which I also respect.
Yeah, everything's figuring out your process and what works for, honestly, project to project too. Mm-hmm.
All right, so next up, in terms of what your process is, we wanted to talk about managing your career this week. It's something that, frankly, you can never talk about enough. I feel like people never talk about it at all, like thinking strategically about their career. But I remember like having a great conversation with a friend of mine who is a writer at a certain point in his career, like about like the balance between like the ambition jobs you're working on in like your passel of jobs, like how many cash flow jobs you have going, how many ambition jobs, and how does that feel? And what is that? And like, I was like, people never talk about this, but we all should be talking about it more. So this week, managing your career, and we're going to follow that up with a general meeting. Jason, you want to kick it off?
Yeah, it's so funny. Gigi and I started talking about this last week, and we've, you know, it's one of those conversations you have outside of school that you're like, let's bring this into the classroom, so to speak, right? Into the podcast. But managing my career is something that I honestly, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Charles. Like, it's not something I thought about until I was older. And I was like, oh, this is something that needs to be managed. And a lot of times the screenwriters, directors and the like, we talk about like, oh, your agent works for you and you're the boss and you're doing these things. But it's so hard to actually sit down and say like, oh, I'm the boss. I am the manager here. I should be looking at how the business takes things in and out. And honestly, like, I don't think I thought about it until I had to incorporate. And then I really felt like it. I was like, these bills are going out the door. Who's paying for this stuff? Like, where do these commissions come in? And since then, sat down and really said like, okay, if the Heller Maniacs Corporation is, you know, the thing that I'm the CEO of, well, you know, what am I doing? Like, what is it? And it's not just, you know, your projects and different things, but a lot of it's like, what are your professional goals and different things? And can't remember how Gigi and I got on the topic, but, you know, I just sit down every year and write a list of goals. But
I think I said, like, how do you do it, Jason? Yeah. You're so prolific. So prolific.
Well, yeah, I sit down and write goals every, and I do it in December, right? Because I think anything you do in January gets lost late in the sauce in Hollywood. It's too late. It's just like, for me, just knowing that it's a goal, like a list of goals I have to talk about with my reps that in like the Sundance flurry and then also Berlin or whatever, these other film things are going on, like it's hard to get anyone's attention. So right around after Thanksgiving, I sit and spend a couple of weeks just writing like, what are my goals? My 2024 goals were like, you know, work at a studio on a rewrite, sell these two specs that I had finished, sell something this year that's a spec screenplay, whether one of these two I finished or the new one I'm starting writing. And then, you know, I had worked in TV last year, so it was like, take a couple more TV meetings. And then a lot of it just has to do with like what I want to book or like where I want to be when it comes to like the end of leveling up my career, right? So like, how do I get from the level I'm at to the next level? These are different things. So I write these goals out and then I just write a personal note to my manager. And I'm like, hey, let's have lunch. Let's talk about these. Because also sometimes you need to hear some of like the rude awakening stuff of like, hey, you know, saying you're like, oh, my goal is to direct a $50 million feature. Well, you're not going to get that, right? Your goal could be to do something else. It could be to direct something smaller. It could be to package something yourself. It's writing these realistic goals, sitting with my manager, and then also hearing his ideas on how to make these goals possible. So I think at the end of the day, when you're managing your career, what you're really doing is checking in with the people who you've assigned, right? Your manager or your agent are the people that you're setting out into the world to pitch yourself, really. I mean, obviously, like you're doing it, but they're setting the meetings, they're bringing the stuff in. So I always think if I give them some direction of like, hey, this is what I think would be a productive year, when I sit in front of them, I can hear their plan too. And I do think, you know, what's the old expression, like the squeaky wheel gets the oil. You don't have to be squeaking all the time to get the oil, but I think at the top of the year, I love to be at the top of my rep's mind and then kind of go from there.
I like that you bring up the idea of, you know, you don't have to be squeaky to be advocating for yourself. And I think that a lot of people in these situations where they're kind of, it's maybe their first time working with a representative, they feel like they feel bad even asking for this type of thing, but it's very like, it's very fair. It's very like expected. And I think it's something to be testing out if this is a good fit, because if you are ultimately the person where the buck stops with you and you are the one who's driving the direction that your career is going, of course, being receptive to feedback from these people who who have expertise in this space, you should be able to like feel that sort of kismet energy where it's like, okay, yeah, like you're not going to be able to do the $50 million studio feature, but like, if that's the like goal, that the horizon goal that you're working towards, what can you be doing this year to set yourself up? So like 10 years down the line, that's like just in the mix and not even a question. And you're building this long-term strategic relationship with this partner or partners that is also a strategic career building move. 2 weeks ago when we had Annalisa Moravina on, she was talking about like, especially in this consolidating industry, where it's going to be tough the next 10 years. We do need to be strategic and specific with our goals. And Jason, you mentioned these like quantifiable goals that you identify every year. And that way, once a year passes, you can actually look back and say, okay, so how did I do? And what were the other factors that either impacted something happening or something not happening? And if you did everything that was on your list to the best of your ability, like you wrote that sub $5 million feature, or you like went and pitched 7 TV show ideas, like you can say, okay, I am doing the work. And then there are things that are out of my control.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember, and I obviously had a crazy list of goals, not crazy, a normal list of goals going into 2020, and then COVID happened and I achieved 0 of those goals. And it was crazy frustrating, but also like you couldn't do anything about it. And I felt like, oh, I had done everything right. Felt like my rep also was working, but like you're working in an unprecedented time. No one really knew how things were shaking out. It can be a flick. Those years happen. That was an incredibly frustrating year for me because it felt like I wasn't doing anything wrong. Like the world was crumbling around me, but for me, like 2021 then became a much more important year to have written goals down because it's like, hey, we weren't able to do what we wanted to do in 2020. How do we do that? And honestly, I don't necessarily think I think it was like that those 2 years helped really change my 2022 because I came in being like, we lost 2 years of a career that I wanted to be elsewhere. Now I need to be back on the blacklist. I need to sell something. I want to staff in TV. You know what I mean? It was like finding these things of like, how do I catch up and restart my career when I had 2 down years? Not anyone's fault, but like all of Hollywood did. And I don't have $1 million contract to go back on. Everyone has a short-term memory here. So you just don't know if they're going to remember you. How do you get back into that? So like, it was managing those things because guess what? Those years happen all the time. They don't necessarily happen with a worldwide pandemic, but something could throw you off. I mean, I remember the beginning of 1 year, I wound up having a family emergency and had to kind of go back home for 3 months, wasn't able to do work that like, you know, it alters the course of your year, you do whatever. But if you have these goals written down, not only can you have something to focus on, but you know, I would say it's like passive income. If you have your manager out there pitching you and doing things, you don't necessarily have to be here doing that. You have someone out, like an advocate out there who's bringing it home for you.
I think this is a really good practice as well. If you don't yet have a manager, yeah. I'm about 1 year into having one, and the writing down and setting of the goals has always been there. I think coming out of my past corporate life and even going into my 1 year of film school, the goals in that case were just goals that were, you know, outlined by the program that I was in. And it was really helpful. And then when I left that program, I continued to set specific goals that were really geared towards me developing my skills as a writer-director. So having a pilot that I can share, having a feature that I can share, having a number of shorts, and specifically, I decided to focus on sketches so I could get reps in, and having sort of like a quantifiable thing to fall back on so I can know that I'm building towards experience, which is absolutely necessary in this space. Like you can't just sit back and hope that things will fall into place and hope that, you know, you'll meet someone and then you can tell them this idea that you have. You have to be able to show them the things that you want to do.
Well, it's also about taking it seriously as a real thing. Like, look, we play with dreams. Like, it's movies, it's fantasy, it is a hard career. We all take a swing to do it. But like, you can try and approach that with like rigor and thoroughness and discipline. Because like, look, let's say the best case scenario that could ever happen happens and you write one script and the first script you write is magic and it gets made and you like, all of the sudden, you are now in a position where you should ideally need a second script because no one writes one thing that is good enough that gets made that they make enough money to never have to work ever again. So, like, you could choose to try and develop that discipline right now where the discipline is in front of you, or you could, like, if everything went great and you write that magic script, or I guess even the bigger fantasy is, like, you have an idea that's so good that someone pays you to write that script, which isn't a thing. The people who get paid to write something off an idea have already written a bunch of things. Like, having an idea that's so good with no track record, someone pays you to write it, is basically impossible. So yeah, like, treating it as, like, this is a career. We're going to have discipline about it. We're going to figure out each year what we want to turn out. We're going to, like, build structures into our life so that we do it. And then the thing I was talking about before with a friend of mine, we're going to figure out a way strategically where we can pay our rent while we do it. So, like, that particular friend of mine, we were having a conversation because for years while he was starting, he had two blogs that he wrote for regularly that kept his rent paid every month, no matter what. This was like 10 years ago, back when blogs paid better. And then he always thought of it that he's like, I've got bandwidth for five things. So, like, two blogs and, like, three ambition projects, like a feature and two pilots or whatever. And then he was like, oh, I hit this thing where I let the two blogs go because one of the screenwriting things was going.
Yeah.
But then I was like, the screenwriting thing went away and I had five things in my passel, none of which were paying me any money.
Oh.
And so we had this, like, long conversation about, like, strategically, if you want to be in this forever, you will always need money today. You know, like, I feel like there's some commercial we could make, like a hokey commercial, like, structured payment? No, cash now. And it's like, the film industry is very much like, no, I also need cash now. I need to eat. There is no shame in money. And you have to think about strategically, like, all right, what is the thing that's going to keep me paid now while I work on the ambition things?
Yes.
And, like, you have to have the big ambition thing. You need Megalopolis. You need the big project. But, like, even Francis Ford Coppola needed the winery to make Megalopolis a reality. Like, you need to think strategically about, like, what are the cash flow and what are the ambition and how do I balance that? And yeah, you should absolutely be having conversations like that with your management because your management wants to make money off you. And so, like, they should also be excited for you to be having things in the short term that's making money, even if it's not the big thing. Mm-hmm. And we all have the dream of the big thing. And, like, a team of people that you can say this aloud to, it makes it more real, but also can make you recognize when something is more unrealistic. What's funny for me is so much of this also, when I was a freelance DP, I remember talking to directors about their careers a lot during pre-production and strategies and how it's going. And like, so much of this is stuff that I learned when I was crewing for other people, looking at the strategies they were using to actually be in the mix or not. And that is absolutely, like, a vital thing to think through. Because yeah, I mean, you should have a plan. But as Jason points out, like, a plan might not mean anything. 2020 can happen. Years will happen. But I always liked, like, this is another thing I got from spending my 20s on set. The productions that handled chaos better were the ones with a more thorough plan.
Yep.
So, like, we've all been on that shoot where you showed up and the location was lost. I remember this one shoot, we had scheduled a location and during prep, we'd scheduled it, but it was like a rundown house. And we'd begged them, we'd like, don't touch it. This is what we're looking for. This is perfect. I wasn't a director on this. So it was just one of the producing team. And then, of course, we came back on the day and they'd completely remodeled the house.
Oh, no.
Because they knew we were shooting there and they wanted it to be nice. And so it was no longer correct. And so, like, you know, because we had a thorough shoot plan, we were able to, like, move up the next day's thing while we looked for another thing that was character appropriate and yada, yada, yada. But, like, it just always happens on production. Things, unexpected things happen. But the more thoroughly you're prepared, the better you are able to handle when that stuff comes up. And the productions that can't handle the chaos are the ones that have no plans, no backups, no alternatives. Like, you know, you would meet those directors and I would often be like, why are you in directing? You don't seem to want to think ahead about anything. Yeah. And they'd be like, oh, I don't know. Like, you know, you're going to lose a location. So why think too much about it? And I'm like, but then what they would do with the backup location wouldn't be that interesting.
Exactly.
So I think the more thoroughly you can plan, and I love this December idea, because you know the other problem with doing it in January is every other motherfucker's doing it in January.
It's too late.
Well, and also, like, the psychic energy of the universe doesn't have as much, like, foreplanning. But if you're doing it in December, nobody's thinking about next year in December. So the universe has a lot of energy to, like, give you. Ooh, I might switch to a December next year planning session.
A December deep dive.
It's nice. It makes you get, I go into the holidays much more relaxed. You know, part of why I started doing this was I would just have so much anxiety over how I would make money the next year, right? Where is it coming from? What am I doing? And for me, the easiest way to go into Christmas and be present with my family at the holidays and do whatever is knowing that I already had that conversation. So I'm not stressing like, oh my God, when I come back in January, I need to talk to my people and I need to do whatever. If I've had that conversation, and honestly, like my reps are just, they don't have much to do in those last two weeks before a break. So it's like easier to get a lunch, right? But it's like, oh, hey, I went, we had this conversation. It usually, you know, hopefully as always ends well. Their job is to get you in the space that they need you to work hard in. For me, it's a positive mental space, you know? And then I head in the holidays. I'm like, great, I have this. Can also alleviate my parents' stress when they're like, what are you going to do next year? Like, what's happening, you know?
Jason, honey, when? How are you going to pay your bills? I don't know. If
exactly. That's close.
From Brooklyn.
Yeah. You know what? I'll take it. They sound like they are. But, you know, you get that. And then you have answers to questions at family parties. And also, like, think like the glimmer of hope, because as I sit down to start my new spec for 2024, which I started over the weekend, it's like, woo. Yeah, okay, I like feel excited about this. I feel excited typing pages out. I know that I'm on track to meet the goals that I set out. So, yeah.
One thing that I think both of you have brought up is the idea of speaking it out loud and speaking it to someone for there to be accountability. I'm very driven by social pressure. Often I'll tell people like, I'm going to get you a cut of this thing by this day. Because then there's that, you know, contract of accountability of having to deliver on something. And thinking about sort of how I would manage that type of accountability before I had a manager, I think of like actually going to you, Charles, during film school and saying, I'm making this short outside of film school and we're shooting it over Thanksgiving. And I was almost like, I think by speaking to you and Julia Salaminoff and like other people who were leadership within the school community, I was also getting investment from people in leadership positions, investing in my success, giving me advice, lending me lights, like things where similar to like management, you want them excited about the things you're excited about. And if you can get them engaged and invested at an early stage, if they're like, oh yeah, there's definitely something there with that stepmom movie idea, like that's a way to sort of generate momentum at a very early stage. So like those December conversations, whether they're with your dad or your professor or your manager or your partner, like those can be things that you hang on to. And then you have that like accountability buddy vibe at any level.
I also think there's a power in life to saying things out loud that like, forces you even, it doesn't even matter who you are saying it to, but like inside my head, there is no real scale. Like, you know what I mean? There's no measuring tape in my head. There's no like it's all different shapes and sizes and like how big something is. And then as soon as I say it aloud, I'm like, oh, but actually this thing I'm saying aloud will actually take me. Like it can just be talking to a friend, can be just as useful as managers or structures where you're like, oh, I've now said it aloud. So now it's real. And also I can start to like draw a tape measure around like, oh, this will take me 6 months to write. Or like, oh, there's a bunch of research in this. This is going to take longer or whatever. In a way that like when it's in my head, because there's no measuring tape up there, it like scoots and it shifts around. And yeah, there's a power. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I think film school is a great idea, despite the name of this podcast. But one of them is getting in the habit of talking about projects with other people. Setting deadlines, having deadlines to meet, learning the power of like, oh, I made this deadline and I'm doing another. And like those structured things are one of the big reasons I think academics are wonderful because it's very hard. Creative types have to learn how to do that. And it's not natural for a lot of us.
And reasonable deadlines too, you know, I think is not natural for a lot of us.
Mm.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, like especially you need to go through a couple of like, oh, I need that by Friday. Fuck yeah, I'll write an entire feature by Friday a couple times in your life before you're like, oh yeah, this isn't very good. This isn't work I'm proud of. Oh, I actually need to ask for the time I need to do the thing and be real about what that looks like. Yeah, nope. Agree.
Yeah, I talked to a guy the other week who was like, my goal is to write 12, 30-page pilots in 2024. And I was like, why would you just not write 4 and have them all be better than all 12 of the other ones, you know? It's like, you're basically writing a page a day, you know, or half a page a day for the whole year is a long, and look at that when he explained it like that, it seemed reasonable, but also I was like creative burnout characters, like How different are these things going to be? Do you need to learn that much? Do you need to write 12? You know, like it starts boiling down to like, these are ambitious things that maybe aren't realistic. And for me, you know, I'll come full circle. When I write it down and look at it and then have to email it to a rep or to someone else, I find that I am constantly going back to like, what is actually achievable? Because you know what, at the end of the year, my rep could pull that up and be like, hey man, I know you're upset that X, Y, and Z happened, but you didn't do 1, 2, or 4 on this goal list. You know, like I needed a spec from you. Maybe you need, like, I need you to practice this pitch more to get into that thing. And if you didn't do it, blah, blah. So it's like, for me, it's like accountability on both ends. And also realistically, I don't want to ever say anything that someone's going to be like, this guy's crazy. So try to strap it down.
Well, but also, nothing tells me more that that person that you were talking to that we were for some reason slandering, but whatever, I didn't meet them, so I'll go ahead and go into it, doesn't understand what writing actually is.
Yeah.
Like the same way, like, if I'm talking to someone about editing and they're like, oh yeah, I could edit a feature in a week. I'm like, yes, you could physically assemble all the shots in order in a week. But the actual part of editing is like exploring all the avenues, seeing all the directions, and writing, like, could I write a page a day of a screenplay that if screenplays were 300 pages in a year? Could I write 300 pages of a screenplay in a year? Absolutely. Because it's one set of characters and I'm thinking about their motivations and I'm thinking about their backstories and I'm developing that one set of characters and why they collide with each other over the course of a year, totally doable. 12 different projects is 12 different sets of characters. It's 12 different motivations and backstories and collisions. And like, that is the work of screenwriting. The actual writing of a page, it's like when everybody says like, oh, well, ChatGPT is going to come for screenwriters because it can like spit out all these pages so fast. I'm like, the actual typing of the scene is like less than 1% of the work of screenwriting.
Oh yeah. By the time I'm typing the scene, I've done the hard work usually, you know?
Yeah.
That's the easy part.
Yeah. Like the work of picking out who the character is and why you're catching them in that moment in their life and what they need to do to change and why that's compelling. That's the work of screenwriting. And doing that 12 times on 12 projects in a year seems like I would completely rot my brain.
Yeah.
As opposed to like going back to the managing the career thing, like thinking about like, oh, well, how long does it take me to really settle on a character? Like, is 2 specs a year? Like, I always tell students, like, you need to write or develop 2 scripts a year. Whoa, write or develop scripts. I feel like 2 scripts a year is a very reasonable amount of, like, I can spin up a world, I can think about things. But I remember so clearly this one time, I was listening to a Francis Ford Coppola interview where he talked about Apocalypse Now. And he talked about, like, well, I was thinking about writing a script from scratch, but I knew a script from scratch for me was 9 months. And I loved that he knew that about himself. And, like, 9 months is how long it took him to do a script from scratch. And like, I guarantee you, he's not spending that 9 months typing. It's 9 months to figure out the things that make the characters work. Mm-hmm. And that's the work of this, like, that's the work of the thing we do. And so, I mean, look, could I drink a lot of coffee and try and write 30, like 12 shitty pilots in a year? Maybe. Would one of them weirdly be good? Yes. But you know, the one that was good would probably have a lot of autobiographical stuff.
Yes.
That you've been working
on your whole life.
Yes. Or there'd be some subconscious plagiarism. And then like 10 years later, I'd look back and I'd be like, oh, this is just the pilot of Cheers. And I did, you know, but like you didn't see it at the time, but you're just like cycling through whatever.
Yeah. I feel like my next stage of my career and growth as a writer is like learning how to do that type of like deep, deep thinking of, you know, going down a million different paths of what a story could be and developing and figuring out the characters and like getting to the point where you're like, well, I think this person is the protagonist, but actually what if it was this person? And that takes so much practice and skill to even be able to conceptually understand that. And yeah, I think, the volume game is not the game that's going to bring any type of interesting content. I think we've seen that. One other thing, I think just to sort of validate the 2 scripts a year, I was speaking with a manager at, what was it, Redefine. They represent their management company. And one of the founders was saying that they did the numbers and the output of their most successful clients is that they are producing on average 2.5 specs, scripts a year. And so I think that's like, you know, taking into account, maybe it's 3 pilots that you're doing a year, maybe it's 2 features, maybe it's a mix But I think that as a like tangible goal that we should all be aiming for as writers or the equivalent, you know, I think as a director, maybe it's like, these are ideas that you're attaching yourself to and helping develop. Or maybe it's, those are the number of shorts that you're creating every year. Though that does feel like that generation of output is something that we can hang our hat on.
I would say that 2.5 number, first off, love to hear it. Love to hear that kind of first person research from the field. I'm guessing that those people don't have other cash flow jobs, the 2.5 scripts a year. I feel like two scripts a year is the like, and I'm still working in some other way that is bringing me in cash. I feel like that's,
for example,
more realistic.
Working at no film school.
Or like teaching or doing any of the other things.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. As a director, that's why I always call it WODES, write and or develop scripts. Because like Ridley Scott didn't write the two scripts that he had ready when he got meetings because someone else won Cannes, who was an English commercial director. But he had two scripts he had developed. And as a director, you should be involved in the development of those projects. But I also think it's a good thing because, like, for instance, last year I only finished one thing. And it's because I had a project that I kept going too long on. And eventually, I Stephen King tried to write 11/22/63 20 years earlier. And then eventually was like, I am not up to this, and let it go for 20 years and then came back to it. It's a great book. I really enjoyed it. The show was not as good as the book. There was good stuff in the show. It was a hard book to turn into a show. But like, I had to let a project go. I'm very proud of finishing everything I start. And I got midway through last year and I was like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to hit 2 a year or even 1 a year if I give this one any more time. And I had to shut it down. And like, it hurts my pride because I'm like, I want to be someone who finishes what I start. Yeah. But I also had to reach that place of like, oh, I am actually not up to writing this right now. There are things in this that I do not have the skills to do. And if Stephen King can admit that 10 years into his career of publishing bestsellers, he didn't have what he needed for 11/22/63 and he would come back to it later. Anyone at any point can admit this, not right now. And the discipline of shutting a project down occasionally, rather than spending 5 years of your life on a thing, like, that is also a discipline of saying, nope, not this right now. I have to finish something this year or I am not a professional. And then moving on to a thing that was within your skills, or the ideal thing, like 20% beyond your skills. That's where you want to be. Like, it's like 20% beyond what I can do. I have to grow a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good segue, but, you know, I think the cutting in from like the two things for me when I take general meetings, because that's usually at the start of the year, right? So like probably March and April is when I'll be doing the lion's share of them. Having the two things I want to work on to talk about, aside from whatever the topic is they brought me in, let's say they were at a spec last year or they heard I was working on a project and someone said they should meet me and I'll go in and talk to these people, you know. It's great to have two ideas that I'm working on. Hey, well, you know, because it comes up, where are you from, blah, blah. But at some point, they're going to say, what are you working on right now? And honestly, you could talk about, oh, I'm doing this movie and blah, blah. But also, like, I have a couple ideas for specs. One is, here's this log line. And, you know, if they are into that and the conversation takes off from there, I like to just stay on that topic the whole time, you know, get them interested, mostly because I know there's like a 0.01 chance they would ever pay me to write an idea, as Charles has said, but good to have a fan, somewhere to go. And if they're like, oh, that's interesting, you know, like, we're already doing something like that. Great. Well, I know that's strike one. So then I'm like, oh, and I'm also working on boom. And then you have number two, right? To see if that sparks. And if neither of them spark, you just go back to like, I'd love to find something with you. What are you interested in? You know, like, there's different ways to do it. But I do think, you know, I was talking to a newer writer who was going out on their first meetings and she and I were having a great conversation, but she was like, I just don't know what to do in these things after. I feel like it's a date where I'm waiting for them to ask me questions. And it's like, yeah, executives are supposed to kind of lead those generals. But like any date, even if it's going poorly, give some of yourself too. What are you guys looking for? What are your passion projects? What do you want to do? Because I do think getting in with these people and learning what they're into is a good way to figure out, like, what should I be pitching to these companies later? If there's ever a book, if there's a news article I could bring through. You know, if I know who these people are as people, then it's an easy conversation to have in the next meeting with them.
One of the things that I took away from a conversation that Jason and I had last week was this idea of finding that potential seed to work towards something with from these general meetings. So that way you're coming out with like, oh yeah, you're interested in this type of thing. Let me like noodle on that and get back to you. See if like there's any, if any of my ideas feel interesting to you. And that work of being able to continue the conversation to build the relationship and also to create an opportunity where you can show a development exec how wonderful you are to work with. I just thought that was so smart and so just a tangible goal that people can work towards when coming out of a general meeting. Obviously, you don't want to like force yourself on anyone. And if there's, especially if like you feel like the vibes are off and you don't have any chemistry with this person and you definitely don't want to go on a second date. But if there's like a tiny little creative crush there, or you just like this person in general, like what is one tangible thing that you can do as follow-up and continue the conversation and, you know, potentially go down a road of like, let me come up with a sort of treatment, see if it resonates with you at all. And what that does is it creates a warm room for the future. So say 2 years down the line, you're like, you know, the idea that you guys were exploring sort of like didn't really connect, but then you deliver on one of your annual goals. And then you're like, hey, I wrote this. Maybe it's interest, but you have that open door. And I think that is kind of the goal that you want to be going towards when you have these general meetings is creating a network of warm rooms of people who are invested in you as a person and as a creative and that you just want to be able to hang out with, because ultimately what would be the next stage and the next iteration is hanging out a lot with this person and being able to have these like open creative conversations to take something to the next stage.
Yeah. I mean, I that's all great. I love that. I love the warm room idea. I love the like, also I'm always wary of making too many dating analogies, but I think Jason's dating analogy is appropriate in that like many people start their dating career, especially if they like watched sitcoms as a child, thinking a date is about impressing someone, like fancy restaurant, nice outfit or whatever. And then eventually you grow up to the point where you're like, oh, dating is about us getting to know each other. And it's the same with job interviews, right? Like when you are first on the job market, when you're fresh out of college and you just want a job, you're like, I just want to impress you. But then eventually you're like, oh no, I'm here to get to know about the company I might work for just as much. And like, you know, I'm now an academic and a filmmaker. And so I'm on the other side of a lot of job interviews. Now I'm hiring people sort of semi-constantly. And the people who treat it as, we are both equals, you have an opportunity, and I have a lot of questions for you. Like, it's always such a flag for me if I'm like, do you have any questions? And they're like, nope. I'm like, but aren't, like, you should have questions for me, not just to show me that you have questions, but also like, you want to teach and you might want to know what our pedagogy is and what our philosophy is. Like, in my job interview at Brooklyn College, I was like, how expensive is the school and how much student debt do the students graduate with? Because that was really important to me. I didn't want to teach at a very really expensive school. And it sparked a whole long conversation. And we had like a very productive time about that. And like, now that I'm an adult, I really recognize that like these meetings, like dates, like job interviews, we are both trying to get information about the other person. And we're trying to find out like, oh, what are you interested in? Because honestly, like you might take a meeting with someone and they are legitimately interested in stuff that you are just not a fan of. And you're like, oh, we'll probably not work together because like the things that your favorite five movies are bad. And I don't have to say that in the meeting because why would it be in anybody's case? But like, it is likely that nothing I write will be that interesting for you because you are really into this thing that's just not my thing. Yeah. And that's fair. I'm not going to yuck anybody's yum. But you are there to find out what they are excited about. And like, that's, you know, it's a conversation. It is not a dance.
Yeah.
You are not like putting on a show. You're there to like, be like, hey, we're all professionals who might work together. What are the things you guys are psyched about these days?
Yeah. It's always refreshing to hear that too. And it brings me back to like why I think I was good at selling ads, because I would just go into, luckily I worked for places that I was excited about, the last place being a podcast company. I just go into these meetings and be excited about podcasts because I love podcasts and I loved what Gimlet was doing. And usually there'd be one person in the room or one person who proactively reached out because they were already excited about podcasts. And then we'd just like geek out together. And otherwise, like if I was in a room, you know, I presented in front of 50 C-suite people for like Bank of America. And all I would do was go in there. I'd say a professional skewing version of myself. Like I'd wear my, you know, power pants and and know that I was presenting in a way that was professional. And but then I'd just be like, this is why I'm really excited about what we're doing in this space. And if even if nothing came out of the meeting, like just being myself and being excited and seeing people sort of like light up and get excited about this my excitement, like that is contagious. And it's just, you know, it's not personal if it doesn't work out. Like there's so many other opportunities. So I think taking that pressure off really helps. And I know we've talked about this in the past, but like I recommend everybody take an improv class because it like forces you to get out there and fail a ton and embrace it and like be okay sort of being present in the moment. And I think that's something that really, really helps with general meetings. And yeah. I can also totally see why both of you guys are probably like killer meeting takers because you're both, you show up, you're curious, you're present, you're listening, and you guys are not holding back on who you are. And I love that. I think that's just like, again, contagious.
Yeah. If you want to make a movie, I think in Hollywood, the average time it takes, like theoretically, is like between 3 and 5 years. And I feel like if you're meeting with a company that you might want to make a movie with, you are meeting people that you might be with for 3 to 5 years. So a lot of it for me is like, do I want to take this time to be with these people? You know, like, and even if it moves fast, the next 2 years, a year of writing, a year of trying to make it and releasing it, like that's a long time. TV, obviously, like this is, you're getting into bed for even longer, right? So yeah. Hopefully in the best case scenario. So it's figuring out like, do I want these people in my lives? Are we doing this? And then like important questions to ask, do you have a development fund, right? If I come to you with an idea, can you pay me to write it? If I come to you with a pitch, can you buy that pitch or buy that treatment or commission the script from me? What, you know, do you have that? You know, what's your track record in releasing stuff? Are you bringing it to movies? Would this be the first feature your company has done? Or like, you know, have they ever done TV before? Because they could be a real big name in movies, but they've never done TV. You're both starting from scratch. It's like, those are the questions. And, you know, you find ways to ask, like, what are you guys working on now? You know, what are your ideal kind of projects? What's a movie that came out last year, a TV show that came out last year that you wish you had done in here? You know, like things like that. You know, do you have a relationship with showrunners? You know,
I have a question about like that. Do you have a development fund? Yeah. This is where the imposter syndrome flag comes up for me. And you guys can tell me if I need to just knock it right down. To me, as somebody who is in the emerging space, like I've only been paid to write and direct one thing. Everything else has been like self-financed, scrappy. And like, I feel like it would be, I'm too green to ask if they have a development fund.
Then make your rep ask. I guess that's what I always say. Okay. Like if you don't want to, your rep should be able to figure that out and find out either way. I just try to find a way that comes up naturally. If they're like, we're doing this project with Gigi and Baba. I'm like, oh, cool. Do you guys have a development fund or is this a spec you guys brought in? You know, just figuring
keep
out
cash.
That. Exactly. Keep cash. You don't have to be like, do you have a development fund to pay me? You know, I was right, just like, right. do you have it to buy different things? Are you doing whatever? Because a lot of these companies nowadays don't. What they have is like an overall deal at like a Netflix or a Warner Brothers or whatever. And what they say is like, oh, well, you'll bring that. If you wrote it on spec, then we could bring the spec in, but we don't have a money to pay for those sorts of things now. And then I like keep that in your back out. Good to know. I think that's great. Whenever I'm done that spec, I'll definitely make sure it comes back here. But you know, you don't give anything for free right away. But yeah, find a casual way or just tell your rep, hey, like I loved meeting with Charles Hain of the Hain Corporation. Like how to, you know, do they have a development fund? You know, and your rep should know either right away, be like, let me check. I know they have a deal with Amazon. I know they have a deal with Brooklyn College Studios. Let's see if they have any cash, you know, whatever that is.
Also, the first time you ask will feel weird. And the third time you ask will feel normal. Yep. Like, you know, one of the beauties of doing other things while you are going is like, I am now comfortable. Like if you had told me the budgets I would be working with on projects, like the week after I got out of grad school, I'd be like, that's so much money. How do you sleep at night? And then, you know, you do a bunch of music videos and you do commercials and you build up a thing. And now it's like, okay, I am comfortable with like, managing sums of money that would have terrified the fuck out of me when I was 24, because like you just get used to it. And you're like, oh, and I've delivered a project and I know where it went and we paid our taxes and we did our thing. And like the same with all of that is like, the more you do it, the more you get used to those kind of things. And you're like, okay, I am comfortable with that. I mean, frankly, a well-structured career ends up escalating and scaffolding kind of naturally, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You shouldn't be in meetings with things like, you shouldn't be in meetings where you're forced to talk about things that you feel too green to talk about anytime soon, because you'll be in a bunch of meetings beforehand that will prepare you to get there so that when you are there, it feels like a completely natural thing.
Speaking of a completely natural thing, let's see if this segue works. Jason and I have a new mini segment that we're going to be doing for the next couple of weeks. And we're springing it on you in real time so you can use your improv skills to react in real time. The segment is narrative lessons from the show Survivor. Because we both watch it and we both are learning a ton about characters and script and drama from the show. And we want to use the last couple minutes of our podcast to talk about learnings. Are you in? Do you watch? What are your thoughts and feelings?
Yes, I am in. And I have never seen an episode of Survivor in my life.
Even better.
Perfect. Go ahead, Jason. I was going to say, I turned to the show. I returned back to it, you know, after probably 20 years of not watching it, while in the middle of my movie, because I was kind of burnt out on narrative that I needed something that was a little bit different. I also wanted to watch more Mike White because I finished The White Lotus, but now I'm in, so much so that I like am in part of a draft and there might be spoilers. And today I want to talk about introducing an ensemble from this first episode of season 46. And I think that this first episode did a really good job introducing us to, you know, all 18 players, but zeroing in on the narrative drama of this particular tribe that ultimately led to the voting out of this person who I actually drafted as the winner of Survivor. And
Come on, I could have told you he was never going to make it past even to the merge.
Oh man, Jelinski. Yeah. But I thought that they did a really good job setting the tone for, you know, the dynamic of a tribe. There were characters who were, or people who were clearly sticking out as like the protagonist trying to bring people together. And then there was the underdog. And then there was the guy who thought he was really good and chill and killing it. And then everything that all of his actions were telling us a different story. So that dynamic was established very, very quickly in this episode.
Yeah. What I love about Survivor, and I've written on No Film School before about how I think sometimes watching reality TV, and in that article, I particularly talk about Survivor, is a way to just like see humans making decisions that you disagree with or you agree with. And then figuring out like, oh, how did I put that on the page? How did the producers of this show convince me one way or another? But you know, what Survivor does really is like, I find it to be very Game of Thronesy, where it's like people will say what they're going to do with their actions, but their actions won't always lead to what they've decided the ending would be. And this guy who got voted off week one, he talked a big game. When it came time to do the big things, he was always falling flat on his face. And I thought like, that's such an interesting character, a guy who, you know, was hugely excited about different things and happy to be there, but also like couldn't back up his actions with any words. But yeah.
And there's this great element of juxtaposing him with this other character, an athlete. I'm blanking on the guy's name, but they had this task that they both stepped up for, filling these barrels of water to earn, with a clear goal of earning tools for their tribe. And the guy who ended up getting voted off gave up halfway through because he looked at the ticking clock and he was like, there's no way we're going to do this. And the other guy was like, why are we giving up? Why are we giving up? And I know who I am automatically behind. It's the person who doesn't give up. And I just thought it was a very interesting character juxtaposition that ultimately like led to this payoff at the end where it's like the person who gave up, his team gave up on him.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a good, I think like a lot of narrative lessons in there. And I also think it's one of the best shot and edited shows on TV. You know, like they really know how to pace an episode. You're never bored. They get you in and out in under an hour with commercials. And look, if you're bored at home, like I was during the pandemic, there's 45 seasons of Survivor. I remember just like, where I was like, I think I watched until season 8 when I was a kid. I just picked up from 8 and watched all the way through 40. And hopefully there's not a pandemic again, but there's so much to learn, so much drama. You know how to write a liar and do a big reveal and lots of plot twisty things they experiment with in the later seasons. So it's definitely worth checking out. And I think like as we write our goals down, you know, it's important to try and, even though it feels like the bucket's leaking and you have to fill up something bigger, you could always walk away from your goals, but it means you won't accomplish the ones you walk away from. So staying in your lane and persevering is something I think is always gets rewarded on Survivor. And I think something that will always reward you too, hopefully in your film career.
All right. I should check this show out. Seems like people like it.
45 seasons. What could go wrong?
46 seasons.
Yeah. Somehow I've missed it. I watched the 30 Rock episode MILF Island. Is that is that basically the same?
You know what? Honestly, highly accurate. Yeah.
Okay. I love that episode of 30 Rock. I you know, as long as there's a 30 Rock reference, I can hang. All right, that's it for the podcast this week. This was a great episode. I feel like I learned stuff. I'm on the internet at Charles Hain, various places, and yeah.
Woo. I'm at Lost in Graceland, and tomorrow we have an interview with the director of Damsel, Juan Francis Fresnadillo, and it was such a fun interview, and I loved the movie, and I'm just like, I think your daughter's a little too young for it, Charles, but I'm so glad she's growing up in a world where this movie exists.
Ooh, I can't wait to see that.
I'm at Jason and whatever they are, Twitter, and at Jason Hellerman, Twitter, and the Blue Sky, and all the things, Jason at nofilmschool.com. You know, a lot of good articles coming out this week. We had some pretty good discussion over what gets used and when, and AI, and all sorts of fun things. And, you know, keep listening, and we're excited to keep chatting about this stuff.